from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
It's been just over 2 weeks now since demonstrators first took to the streets of Louisville and elsewhere to speak out against racism and express their outrage over deadly police violence against black people. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we'll talk about what has transpired over that time and what steps government officials are taking to address protesters' calls for change. We'll also discuss the idea of overhauling police departments. That's what they did 8 years ago in Camden, New Jersey. We'll talk with the former Camden mayor and a Rutgers University professor about how it was done. And Kentucky Congressman John Yarmuth joins us to talk about the Justice in Policing Act of 2020, proposed by dozens of House and Senate Democrats. We want to hear from you, too. Call us with your comments and questions this hour on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, today we're continuing our discussion of racial justice and police violence against African Americans that has sparked protests around the world and here in Louisville for the past 2 weeks. Later in the show, we'll take your calls at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. Send us a tweet at WFPL News, and we're also on Facebook. We want to start the show by getting caught up on some of the developments over the past week. And to accommodate everyone's schedules, we're recording this first segment ahead of time. Joining us are WFPL City reporter Amina Elahi and Ryan Van Velzer, who's WFPL's Energy and Environment reporter. Both have been covering the protest and related developments here in Louisville. Amina, let's start with you and get caught up on the Breonna Taylor shooting investigation. She was killed in March in her apartment by Louisville Metro Police, who had a no-knock warrant. The city's Public Integrity Unit, State Attorney General, and federal officials are still conducting their investigations into what happened. Louisville Metro Police released some documents this week about the shooting, but they seem to raise more questions than they answered, right?
That's right. They released the incident report from the night that Breonna Taylor was shot, which was March 13th, and what they released was really quite something. There's very little information in the form. All it basically gives you is sort of the date, the time, who was involved, and then it includes some inaccuracies such as the fact that there were no injuries and that they did not force entry. We know both of those things to be false. The other weird thing about it is that it's come so long after people have been requesting it. I'm sure every news outlet in town has asked for it. And we're almost 3 months to the day that Breonna Taylor was killed, and so it's somewhat surprising to see so little information in that report.
And we're still awaiting the conclusion of the various investigations into what happened that night, right?
That's right. The police investigation is ongoing. They've been turning over their materials, you know, as I guess they complete them to Daniel Cameron, Kentucky's Attorney General, who will review those and decide whether to pursue criminal charges against the officers. At the same time, the FBI is investigating, and that's ongoing.
And Ryan Van Velzer, there were some developments or some new information that came out this week in the case of the David McAtee shooting. He was shot after the protests began as National Guard troops and Louisville Metro Police moved into West Louisville to break up a crowd that had gathered. There was a curfew at that time. And he was shot. Some new information came out from state officials this week. What have we learned in that?
Yeah, okay. So earlier this week, Michael Brown, who's the secretary of the state's executive cabinet, gave a press conference along with Governor Andy Beshear. And he said that the fatal shot that killed David McAtee came from the Kentucky National Guard, not LMPD. However, it's important to note that the National Guard was not actually the lead on that operation that night. It was actually LMPD National Guard was following LMPD, even though National Guard was the one who fired the fatal shot. They say there was two National Guardsmen who fired, but they are unable to tell which Guardsmen fired the fatal shot because of the way the bullet was destroyed.
Now, police LMPD has said that McAtee had a gun and fired at them. They returned fire, and J. Michael Brown seems to back up that claim. Right?
Yeah. It's not clear where McAtee fired, which direction he fired in, but they do say that McAtee was the first to shoot. Although there is, in video footage, there does seem to be at some point that LMPD also shot pepper balls into the area.
Now, the officers involved in the shooting, the LMPD officers, did not have their body cameras activated. Of course, that led to the firing of Police Chief Steve Conrad. But this investigation is far from complete, right? There's still interviews to take place and other things that have to be covered.
Exactly. It's definitely ongoing.
All right, you're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL. We're talking with WFPL's Amina Elahi and Ryan Van Velzer, who have been covering everything that has transpired over the past couple of weeks following the protests that erupted here in Louisville over the shooting death of Breonna Taylor. Amina, I want to come back to you. The mayor has announced a review of the police department, and he's putting out a request for proposals for that. And he's also officially launched the search for a new chief, right?
That's right. The review was announced last week, and the city is seeking an outside agency to perform that. Basically, they want to turn the department inside out, see where there are problems, and I guess get recommendations for how they might improve some of the dysfunction that is apparently occurring. But Mayor Fisher actually referred to that review yesterday in social media posts when he was responding to the nearly blank incident report that you and I were just discussing. He said that's unacceptable to have a report like that, and that's why we need the top-to-bottom review. So that the request for proposals is still going to be open until next week, and then it'll probably be several months until we see any results from that.
And Ryan Van Velzer, you've been out with the protesters since the early days, days when the police were out, the state police were out, the National Guard came out, and police were using tear gas. This week, police were talking about that, the interim chief of police, Rob Schroeder, about the use of tear gas as a tactic during the protest. But you were out. I want to play this little piece of tape first. You were out with some of the protesters who experienced some of that tear gas.
Spit it out.
Are you all good?
I'm good. You good?
Now, many years of journalism, I have not had the experience of being around tear gas, but it sounds like it's pretty rough.
It's a painful experience. I'm not sure that I really know how to talk about it yet.
Yeah, but the interim chief of police, Rob Schroeder, talked about the use of tear gas as a police tactic. Let's hear what he had to say. This was earlier this week.
I know several peaceful protesters got caught up in situations where tear gas had to be used. And I regret that those people had to experience that, had to go through the effects of tear gas.
And Ryan, the chief has announced a change in policy regarding using tear gas, right?
Yeah. So Schroeder announced a revision in the city's use of tear gas following LMPD's use of chemical irritants. And so he said going forward that in order to fire tear gas, for officers to fire tear gas, that order must come from the chief of police or from an official that they designate. And the reason that he did that is because there were several instances over the course of that few days where police fired on peaceful protesters for what appeared to be no reason.
Now, Amina, protesters have called for the officers involved in Breonna Taylor's shooting to be fired and criminally charged. The mayor has resisted firing them, citing a union contract and state law, saying let the investigation run its course. But the demonstrators have taken their demands literally to his front door, right?
Yeah, for several nights in a row now, we've seen the caravans of people marching, driving past Mayor Fisher's house at night. And so it sort of gives new meaning to that phrase that you hear them chanting, no justice, no peace. They seem intent on interrupting the mayor's sleep and reminding him at all hours of the night that this is an issue that they're not ready to give up on.
But those protests have generally been peaceful. And again, this is a very, exclusive area of town near Cherokee Park.
Those protests, like the demonstrations that we're seeing in other parts of the city, downtown and elsewhere in the Highlands, they've been peaceful, and they've grown in how organized they've become as well. But what we're seeing outside the mayor's house is a lot of ruckus, but nothing more than that.
Speaking of protests, Ryan, you've covered them from the beginning. They were we had the tear gas and the tactics in the first few days, but it seems now that the protests have become more tightly organized, and the police are letting them do their things.
Yeah, actually, so there was the Thursday on May 28th when it started, and then that following Monday was the last time police used tear gas and pepper balls. Since then, you've seen the protests become more and more organized. There's several different organizations, including the Kentucky Alliance Against Political Repression and Racism, as well as Louisville Showing Up for Racial Justice and Black Lives Matter Louisville. They're all organizing different protests all over the city and focusing on different, and have each protest has its own emphasis.
And they are no longer limited to the downtown and adjacent areas. They moved out to the Jeffersontown area and St. Matthews as well, right?
Right.
Let's talk about Confederate statues or Confederate-related statues for a moment. There's a meeting of the Historic Properties Advisory Commission today in Frankfort. That's the group that oversees the monuments and other things around the state capitol. But that meeting today could determine whether a statue of Jefferson Davis is removed from the Capitol Rotunda, and many have called for that for years. Davis, of course, the president of the Confederacy. But earlier this week in Louisville, the Castleman statue, as we call it there in Louisville, came down, Ryan. Castleman served in the Confederate Army, later served in the U.S. Army, and later renounced his support of slavery and became a businessman and prominent citizen here in Louisville. But that statue has been a source of contention for a number of years. It finally came down this week.
Yeah, it is a saga. I mean, if you lived in Louisville here, I mean, it's hard not to live in Louisville and have heard about what was going on with the Castleman statue. And it was actually back in August 2018 when, Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher announced that the city would remove the statue. However, there was a bunch of legal hurdles in the way, and it wasn't actually until last week when a circuit court upheld Louisville Metro's decision to take down the statue.
And it will be placed somewhere else in Louisville, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding, but I'm not sure about that.
I believe it's going to Cave Hill Cemetery, where Castleman is buried.
Not far from where it was, Cherokee Triangle.
That's right, very, very close to that. Well, I want to thank you both for your time and for your coverage of all this. And Ryan Van Belzer, Amina Elahi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There have been some new developments since our conversation with Amina and Ryan. Last night, the Louisville Metro Council passed an ordinance banning the use of no-knock warrants, such as police were executing the night Breonna Taylor was killed. And Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky says he'll sponsor legislation banning no-knock warrants nationwide. As we head into the break, some singing from the Louisville protests, recorded by Ryan Van Velzer. This is In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
I'm gonna lay down my burdens down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. I'm gonna lay down my burdens down by the riverside. I'm gonna study war no more.
Welcome back to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. The recent protests over police violence have included a call by many to change the way police departments operate. We've heard the word defund a lot in recent days, and some are calling for government funding for police to be diverted. to other areas to address social and social justice issues. Others say the culture of police departments needs to change, with more community policing, officers establishing relationships and ties with the neighborhoods they served. Here in Louisville, Mayor Greg Fisher has called for a comprehensive review of Louisville Metro Police, and the city has begun its search for a new chief. We thought it would be interesting and maybe helpful to find a city that has revamped its police force and talk to some of the people involved in it. In 2012, faced with a high crime rate and corruption within the department, the city of Camden, New Jersey, dissolved its police department and built a new one. That move is getting a lot of attention these days, as you might imagine, and Mayor Dana Redd was the mayor of Camden at the time. She joins us now to talk about that process and what other cities can learn from it. Welcome to the program, Mayor. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me, Rick. Thank you for allowing us to share the story of our policing paradigm shift and our community policing model.
Also joining us, we have Dr. Watson with us. Brad, Dr. Watson is with us. Dr. Naima Watson, Associate Chancellor for Civic Engagement at Rutgers University Camden and a lifelong Camden resident. Dr. Watson, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to hear from everyone who wants to talk about this process that took place in Camden and what the future holds for police departments across Kentucky and across the country. Call us at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet if you like. WFPL News is our handle, and we're also on Facebook. Mayor Redd, give us an overview. Give us a sense of what Camden was like in terms of police, public safety, and criminal justice before this overhaul took place.
Certainly. So as I reflect back to 2010 and 11, and certainly to put the conversation in context, our new policing paradigm really resulted due to a fiscal crisis that we were facing in the city. If you recall, we had a downturn in the national economy. Camden was facing a significant budget shortfall. And then at the same time, we were experiencing a public safety crisis. And in 2011, I laid off half of the police department when we failed to achieve concessions from our police and fire department at the time. And that really propelled Camden to the national stage back in 2011. But we never stopped looking for a solution. The short-term solution was to rehire all of the former members that had been laid off, because certainly we could not continue to provide for the safety of the city with half the complement. And we also explored a long-term solution, and that long-term solution was the community policing paradigm under the Camden County Police Department. So we explored conversations with Governor Chris Christie, Freeholder Director Lou Capelli, and others about creating a new Camden County Police Department and the city of Camden joining it.
And just so folks who may not be familiar with Camden, the population is roughly in 75,000, something like that?
Yes, between 75 and 77,000 is our population.
But you're right across the river from Philadelphia.
Yes, directly across from Philadelphia. We are the gateway into New Jersey for southern New Jersey.
So talk a little bit about how this worked and how long this process took, and how did you have to require city council approval and that sort of thing? Just can you kind of lay out the steps that took place?
Yeah, so, you know, basically, you know, it started with getting the right people on board to embrace the concept of standing down one department while standing up a new department. And City Council was a part of that process, along with other political and governmental leaders, and most importantly, having transparent and open communications with residents, with the community, clergy, business leaders, and stakeholders. We needed to make sure that we were building consensus around the proposed innovative solution. And so that was a starting point. And the process took, I would say, roughly 2 years, really to address some of the legal and technical aspects of creating a new department while dealing with a department that was in play that would ultimately be stood down as we made the transition. And I'm really proud of the work, this body of work. Chief Scott Thompson was at the forefront of of, you know, a lot of the work that we see today, and that work is being continued under the current leadership of Chief Joe Wasaki. And I think you see the culmination of the work and just the peaceful protests that happened 2 weeks ago with police and community standing in solidarity against the death of George Floyd.
Now, yeah, I know you had severe economic troubles. This was at the height of the recession. But at that time, were there racial problems involving the police, a racial component, such as we're seeing today in so many cities across the country?
So I would say, listen, we've had our share of racial problems with the police department probably decades ago. We were dealing with a corruption case that we were able to manage in the court of law. But I would say the driving force, in my opinion, was the ability to pay. It was driven by a fiscal crisis. And let me, you know, out of the budget, we had a $26 million deficit in 2011. And I had to lay off almost 300 employees that year. And that also included civilians, might I add. So we laid off, as I mentioned, roughly 50% of the police department. And the police budget really was the largest cost driver for our municipal budget. And so, again, you know, we all were, you know, making tough decisions. We all were taking cuts in our pay, including myself, including members of city council, by taking furlough days during that time. And so, you know, public safety is critical and crucial for any city, you know, first to provide for the safety of the citizens. But if you're looking to redevelopment and revitalization efforts, you can't do any of that work unless you have a safe city.
So how were you able to work with the police union? I guess you had to form some sort of relationship with you know, the rank and file in order to carry this process out.
So the county began getting involved with conversations with the police union, and we on the other side of the aisle as a city government, our conversations were a little different. But again, you know, the police union leadership at that time refused to give concessions in response to, you know, the national crisis and fiscal crisis and Camden's budgetary crisis. And so, you know, while I said we did a short-term rehire of all police officers, we were very transparent in articulating that we were planning to join a newly created department under the county, and that's how the city would provide for public safety in Camden.
And during this transition time, this new paradigm, as you call it, when all this was going on, were there concerns about public safety?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So there were a number. I had a number of community meetings. My whole life, it seemed, was spent in the first 2 years or 3 years of my first term on nothing but public safety. So, yes, we heard from residents, you know, concerned about starting a new department. Would there be a gap in service provision? And so we had to assure them that it would be a smooth transition, moving one department over to the next. And, again, yes, that was a vital and critical concern that we heard expressed throughout the city.
I want to come back to you and talk about the results of all this, but I want to bring in Dr. Naima Watson, Associate Chancellor for Civic Engagement at Rutgers University Camden, lifelong Camden resident. Dr. Watson, I'm interested in your perspective on all this. What were you and your fellow citizens thinking as all of this was going on?
It was a really complex time because not only was the city dealing with this huge challenge in public safety, but we were, as the mayor pointed out, dealing with a huge financial crisis in the city. So unemployment was high. We were also dealing with the challenge of our school district at that time. And so I think another piece of this is certainly, you know, during 2012, which was one of the most violent years on record in the city in recent memory, it was a confluence of significant challenges across the board. And so, you know, it it was the mayor not only dealing with public safety, but understanding that she would have to deal with economic disinvestment and this change in schools. So for residents, you know, myself included, it was a lot to take in at one point, and residents feeling that a lot of these changes were happening without the full input of all of them. But I think, you know, absolutely the mayor did as much as she could to engage as many people as possible in this process. But I think for a city that has faced significant challenges and also issues of disenfranchisement at times, not being able to elect some of its own city leaders or school board leaders, that some residents felt like this was happening to them. Certainly wanting a change in the police department. There were protests across the city, an outcry about the violence that was taking place, and residents wanted something to be done. But it felt like a lot also from a resident perspective to manage that all of these swift changes were happening at once and concerns about what was going to come on the other side. So I think as we, you know, at now can look at this, you know, in hindsight and 7 years later, these changes have proved largely successful. And I think we would not have had, you know, not only the peaceful protests with our current police chief, but another protest that happened last week with younger people that, again, peaceful in nature. And we've had other shifts in the transformation of the city that have all proven successful. But I think that 2010 to, you know, 2013, 2014 period was really hard for residents to grasp the enormity of all the changes that were happening.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We're talking with Dana Redd, the former mayor of Camden, New Jersey, and Dr. Naima Watson, Associate Chancellor for Civic Engagement at Rutgers University. They're talking about the overhaul of the Camden Police Force that took place back around 2012. And so I want to get to what has happened since then, Mayor. Can you talk about some of the success stories that you've seen since this transition took place?
Certainly. Well, you know, certainly we're seeing a reduction in crime across the board. We're seeing 50-year lows in crime across the board. We're seeing an 81% reduction in homicide from 2012, which was the record year of homicides in the city of Camden. We ended that year with 67 homicides. And we're also seeing a 51% reduction in violent crime from that same period of time. So, you know, this is a work in progress, I would say. But what makes this work in Camden is the community's trust in the police force that we currently have. And I would emphasize that, you know, a community's trust in working with the police force will help to improve, you know, the outcomes for public safety. And, you know, when George Floyd was killed, and, you know, the national unrest unfolded across our country and certainly across the globe, Camden didn't have to respond or react to the crisis. They responded. And, you know, they responded in such a way that I believe demonstrated to the world how we were working together in the city of Camden. So our police are already involved in positive social engagements with residents on a regular basis. So whether it's throwing a football in the streets of Camden with a young person or a game of pickup basketball or handing out, you know, ice cream cones on a hot summer day, you know, our police department is quite different than the former department. And I think we are starting to see the fruits of our labor and the fruits of their labor.
Yeah, I was reading up on this, and it seemed like one of the things that took place during the transition was officers almost literally going door to door, but getting out and meeting the citizens one-on-one.
Yes, absolutely. That had been unheard of in the city of Camden. And we heard back from residents. They were pleasantly surprised to see, you know, officers and detectives and sergeants, you know, just simply stopping by on a positive visit to introduce themselves and to hand out their cell numbers that if, you know, citizens had any concerns or wanted to contact members that would be assigned to their neighborhoods, they didn't have to go through 911. They could call them directly. The other thing I would highlight it is the policing philosophy that has been ingrained in this department. One is service before self, and then the sanctity and preservation of all human life. And that has been intentional, you know, through our leadership, first under John Scott Thompson as our chief, and now as Chief Wasaki takes the helm and moves us forward. A lot of reforms have been initiated with this department, and we hope to share our experience with other municipalities and localities throughout the nation that might be helpful to what they do with their department.
Was this costly, financially costly? Did you ask taxpayers to shoulder an extra burden in order to make this happen?
So the taxpayers and the state and others have contributed to this public safety model and what it takes to advance the policing strategies that we currently have in place. But it's not just all personnel. It also involves technology. Camden has one of the real-time operation centers that is state-of-the-art. In fact, when President Obama visited Camden back in 2015, he was given a tour of the internal network, if you will, for our Camden Police Department, then the Camden County Police Department. And we've invested heavily in technology, which serves as a force multiplier for public safety in cities such as Camden.
About a minute or so, a little over a minute, but I want to ask you, you're probably familiar with what we're going through here in Louisville. We're at a crossroads as we are searching. We've launched a search for a new chief. The mayor has ordered a complete assessment, evaluation of the police department. We're taking bids on that. What's your advice for Louisville as we go through our transition?
I think, you know, partnerships are key. In building out, one, the community trust, but also building a model of policing that responds to the needs of your external community. And I know it doesn't happen overnight. This is a work that is an ongoing, conversation. And just being objective, I know that we are seeing a lot of emotion and tension and protests and rioting happening across this nation, and rightfully so. People should react to what they witnessed over 2 weeks ago. But for the mayor and for the council members that are there in your locale, it's important that we work together and that we unify around a common vision and that we work together to achieve the goals in the best interest of the citizens.
And Dr. Watson, quickly, having been through this as a citizen and as someone who works in the city and as a scholar, what's your advice for Louisville?
I think that you have to balance out the objectives that you want. I think one of the things that we've seen here in Camden is that the community policing model, in terms of creating better personal interactions with trust between police and residents, is absolutely paramount and is what has helped us in the success. But people also have to look at the policies that are on the books that are overarching for how police officers operate. And so it's one thing to be in the community and build trust, but they have to be backed up by making sure that use of force policies are in place that ensure that, you know, aggressive force tactics are not used, or when you must use a deadly use of force, that it's the last option, that officers are held responsible when they see wrongdoing by other officers. So as different cities are looking at these approaches, there's a broad range of options they need to consider. So it's not simply, you know, it's nice to have our police engaging with us and building trust, but on the other side of that, we want to make sure that there's policies and procedures in place that that help their behaviors when they're out in the field, because those are the things that are going to impact human life. When you have that interaction with a police officer, when they pull you over, you want to ensure that they're being held by the highest standards, and that this is going to take time. Context absolutely matters, and so what success we've seen here in Camden City would hopefully translate to another place, but they have to take it the context.
I'm going to stop you there, Dr. Watson. I know you're going to come back for the next segment. Mayor Dana Redd, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Congressman John Yarmuth. This is In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome back to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, this week, Congressman John Yarmuth of Louisville and many of his fellow Democrats in the House and Senate unveiled the Justice in Policing Act of 2020. That's a proposal to overhaul police procedures and accountability after the mass protests over the deaths of black Americans at the hands of law enforcement. And joining us to talk about the legislation is Congressman Yarmuth, who represents Kentucky's 3rd District and is the lone Democrat in the state's Capitol Hill delegation. He's co-sponsor of the bill. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Rick. Good to be with you.
And Dr. Naima Watson has graciously agreed to join us for our final segment. She is Associate Chancellor for Civic Engagement at Rutgers University Camden and a lifelong Camden, New Jersey resident. And we've heard, you heard our discussion about how Camden revamped its police department. And we'll talk to her some more as well. Congressman, this is being called one of the most ambitious law enforcement reforms from Congress in years. Let's talk about some of the elements of it. Starting with accountability, this would change the standard for starters under which law enforcement could be prosecuted for misconduct, right?
Exactly. Since 25 years or so, we've been under a Supreme Court ruling that gave qualified immunity to police officers in terms of their ability to be sued for violations of individual civil rights. And it set basically an impossible standard so that, for instance, in the George Floyd case, if you were to sue the Minneapolis Police Department and those officers, you would have had to have pointed to a case that was virtually identical to that case in order to have standing to sue. So we've changed that and made it much easier, assuming the bill is ultimately enacted into law, for an individual to sue individual officers and police forces for violations of their civil rights. And that's a very important provision, not only because it preserves individuals' rights to get compensation for damages they may have experienced, but it also serves as a deterrent for police forces. If they know they're going to get sued, they're going to be much more, hopefully, they would be much more diligent about setting important standards for the use of force and so forth. So it's a very important change in the law, and I hope we get that enacted.
And this would also create a registry of officers who had been, it had been determined that they have committed misconduct.
Exactly. And this is the, you might be able to call that the Tamir Rice provision because, as we know, the officer who shot Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old in Cleveland, was someone who had been fired from a police department prior to that. For irresponsible behavior, and that would have prevented the police force that hired the officer from hiring him. At least would have given the police force notice that he was an officer who'd had trouble before. So all of these would go into a registry, and that way, if a police officer was applying for a job, the hiring police force would understand what his record was.
We're talking with Congressman John Yarmuth on In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. He's one of the co-sponsors of the Justice in Policing Act of 2020. And also with us is Dr. Naima Watson, Associate Chancellor for Civic Engagement at Rutgers University Camden. That's a city that revamped its police department back in 2012. We invite you to join our conversation. Call us at 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet if you don't want to call. Our handle is WFPL News, and we're also on Facebook. Congressman, what are the limits when it comes to for the federal government when it comes to making changes at police departments at the state and local level?
That's a great question, Rick. Basically, the federal government can set standards for prosecution by federal prosecutors under federal law. So, for instance, You can have a civil rights violation that violates federal law, and you can be prosecuted for that. for things other than that, the unreasonable use of force, excessive force, those types of things, that generally, unless it's a federal crime, would not be something we could change. But what we can do is tie federal funding to force a change that would have to be made. So we can't prohibit a police force from using chokeholds at the federal level, but we can tie funding to the police department if they don't ban the use of chokeholds or no-knock warrants, both of which this bill does. It prevents them by federal authorities, but it has a financial disincentive unless the police forces across the country make the same move. So fortunately, in my opinion, Metro Council acted very responsibly in banning no-knock warrants last night, and so we're not going to be threatened with the loss of federal funds if the police, the Justice and Policing Act passes. But that's the way we would do it. Use the withholding of federal funds as an inducement for local police forces to adopt the policies that we want to see adopted.
And there is a no-knock warrant provision in this bill as well.
Exactly.
But that would
and that's for federal drug crimes, mm-hmm. and that's a good example. So we prohibit them no-knock warrants in federal drug cases, but we also again have the financial inducement for cities and states to do the same thing.
Dr. Watson, I'd like to get your opinion on, I don't know how familiar you are with this legislation that's being proposed by the Congressional Democrats, but what's your assessment of it so far?
I'm broadly familiar with it, and I'm in support of it. As I was saying when we were finishing up with former Mayor Dana Redd, building trust with police forces and residents is an absolutely necessary option, but policies are what guide police departments. And so if things are not in place to hold departments and individual police officers accountable, there still are going to be challenges in how not only Black and brown people are policed, but everyone. And so I do think that this piece of legislation is trying to get at the policies that impact actual police action. And those are some of the same policies that we've already implemented here in the Camden Police Department in terms of not using chokeholds, the variety of de-escalation techniques that officers are taught, the use of deadly force when that is appropriate, other holding, officers who simply stand by accountable for actions of the other. So I think these policies are a step to take this further and are absolutely needed.
Let's take a call here. Kirk is in Louisville. Hi, Kirk. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Go ahead. What's your question?
I have a question for Congressman Yarmuth, and I'll take my answer off the air. But just as far as all civil rights laws are concerned, is there any thought of rendering them immune or exempting them from arbitration clauses? The arbitration clauses are a black hole for vindicating your mm-hmm. rights. They, A, render them prohibitively expensive, and B, it denies a public record.
Yeah, it's a great question, Kirk. I don't believe there's anything that addresses that in the bill that we've considered, but that's something that's certainly worth the conversation. And I would hope that as Mayor Fisher and the people he's got reviewing doing the top to bottom review of the Louisville Metro Police Department, that they would consider that as part of their process. I think that's a significant part of the problem. And one of the things we tried to do in this law is to change standards for instance, the excessive use of force. Well, if you have a standard, which most police forces do, that the use of force has to be reasonable, then you've opened it up to so many different interpretations and subjective judgments. And when you get into arbitration, that makes it even that much more confusing. But what we're doing is changing that standard from reasonable to necessary. So it goes from reasonableness to necessity. That changes the dynamic and would make those kind of processes, arbitration, if you're going to again, talk about civil rights and arbitration, it probably makes it a little bit tougher to avoid responsibility and accountability if you toughen the standards, so or narrow the standards. And that's what we tried to do. But you raise a really good point that I hope Mayor Fischer and his people will address.
Congressman, let's talk about the prospects of this bill in Congress. Are you sensing any? There going to be Republican support for it as well?
There will be Republican support in the House. I don't know how much, but there will be support, and I think that it has a very good chance of, or something like it has a very good chance of passing in the Senate. We've seen over the last couple of days Republicans trying to put together their own piece of legislation, and you know, that to me is an indication that what we're thinking about doing is possible. It won't be exactly the same, but we're aiming at, I think both sides are aiming, both parties are aiming at the same goals, which is to hold police department, to allow police departments and communities to hold police officers responsible and accountable, to create transparency and to set standards that are much more in line with what I think the standards of police behavior that I think are much more in line with what the American people expect.
We're talking with Congressman John Yarmuth of Kentucky and Dr. Naima Watson from Rutgers University about policing and other topics related to the protests that have erupted over the past 2 weeks in response to police violence. Let's go back to the phones, and Scott is in Lexington. Hello, Scott. Thanks for joining us.
You know, I was thinking those old no-knock warrants, maybe that was a time when people were more peaceful and they weren't as apt to draw their gun on somebody just walking through the door and start shooting like that. And, you know, the other thing, I think that it works currently where they have the personnel department and they hire people and they determine they have a specific ability to trust that person. It's a very trustworthy person. They do all the vetting and they don't allow them to be sued civilly. I think that will throw a big wrench in the works for them to be able to do their job, because they'll have so much, you know, I don't think you just don't want to allow them to be sued civilly because or criminal. Well, you know, because we've been taken care of before. If it's bad enough, they always get them anyway. So why open them up to all that vicious attacks, civil attacks? That's going to be so redundant. I mean, I think that's just a problem. I mean, that's just a fact of dealing with the criminals and dangerous people in the environment, that you have to have a person you can trust. You have to vet them. That's all you can do. You trust that person. They will do it. You can't constantly have the people they're going after. There's a little bit of overlap, you know, maybe bad things going on, but I don't think it's that much to where they need to start suing the police individually, civilly. And I think that those no-knock warrants are pretty old, back when people used to be less violent, and maybe people are more violent now, and there has to be more consideration before they use one.
Well, thanks for your call, Scott. Go ahead.
If I can make a quick comment on that, it's my understanding, and Dr. Watson, you can embellish or correct me if I'm wrong. The no-knock warrant was basically designed for drug cases when the police officers were afraid, if they announced themselves, that the people inside the facility would then dispose of the drugs, flush them down the toilet or so forth. So the idea was catch them by surprise, so they could get the evidence. That's my understanding of what they were primarily designed to do. And as to your other point about liability, I would just ask you one thing. You know, you have a 75-year-old man who may be brain damaged because the Buffalo police officers pushed him to the ground unjustifiably. Who's going to repair the damage? You know, doesn't he deserve some compensation for having his life changed because of police officers using excessive force? I would argue he does. Clearly, you know, those cases may be few and far between, but I think we have to make accommodations for those people who are seriously injured and damaged by irresponsible police.
And before the time gets away from us, Congressman, I want to ask you about a little bit about the coronavirus pandemic. The House has, of course, approved another relief bill, but Republicans over in the Senate have rejected it. Do you anticipate something emerging from Congress that's going to be suitable to both caucuses and the president?
I think we'll get a package eventually. I think there's going to be a need for some additional money to support small businesses I don't think there's any question that we have to do something to help bolster the budgets of state and local governments who have seen their revenues decline dramatically because of the economic impact of the virus and the actual cost of the virus. And, you know, we've already had more than a half million teachers across the country lose their jobs because of lost revenues at the state level. So we've got to do something. We had almost a trillion dollars in the HEROES Act for state and local governments. I don't think we'll ever get that much, but we need a significant amount to help states and localities recover.
Let's go back to your policing bill. We have a question from Tom in Louisville. Hi, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I was just present at the first night of protest on, I guess, two Thursdays ago, and as part of that, just prayer walk, actually, in front of the Department of Corrections building about a block down the street from where the courthouse is. Just praying for that restraint and that the crowd would stay away from the cops, and the cops would, you know, give them the ability to protest. But as part of that, I got hit 20 times with pepper balls as I was did a prayer circle between the protesters and police. I just wanted to know, any legislation moving forward, if there are any tactics or non-lethal.
Does that call for any? Does it address that? Go ahead, Congressman.
I don't believe this bill addresses those kind of dispersal tactics. Dispersion tactics, I do believe that that's something that we absolutely have to review. And I think probably every mayor, every police chief, and every governor is thinking about that right now. Because we clearly had some, you know, obviously we had a national example of that right across from the White House. And I think the American people think that in many, many cases, those tactics not only injured and damaged, and probably in the case of Mr. McAtee in Louisville, ended up in an unnecessary death, but that we don't like seeing tear gas and pepper bullets and those types of things used on our peaceful citizens, and that's what we saw. So, again, I think that's part of a national discussion, but it's also going on at every level of government, I think, right now.
Just a few seconds left, Congressman. What's the status of the bill in terms of votes and that sort of thing? Will it be up for a vote soon or a committee vote?
Yeah, I think it's going to be marked up, which means it's subject to amendment in committee next week. And then we're scheduled to vote on it on the floor, I think, on the 24th. If it's not exactly the 24th, it's that week.
All right. Congressman John Yarmuth, thanks so much for joining us. And also thanks to Dr. Naima Watson at Rutgers University, Camden. Give our regards to Camden, New Jersey. And want to thank you for joining us well. And thanks to our In Conversation production team, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, Ashley Clark Thompson, Russell Wells, and Bill Burton. And I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.